Mr. Keith Nutter, Real One. Now, when you got back from your leave, you can you tell us about embarking aboard the Empire Orwell and the voyage out?
Yes, certainly. Well, we got back from embarkation leave. We went to Crowborough, which was the training place we were always at. We trained there from Dover Castle days. The Empire Orwell, well, we entrained, first of all, at Crowborough Station with all our kit. I imagine we'd got 45 pattern webbing, I think they called it, the old non-blancoed stuff, so we thought that was pretty good. Anyway, we went down, I suppose, in the three tonners to Crowborough Station. A little humorous thing that were related to me by Sergeant Major Boxall years after, this comparatively last few years, actually. And he said he was talking to the colonel on Crowborough Station as we were all formed up to entrain. And his words, to sort of tidy it up a little bit, he said to the colonel, "Look at this bloody lot," he said. "We're taking these to war, and here they are reading the Beano and Dandy," which summed up the age, really, because we were all pretty young. There was an article I read after the event, and it said... somebody, I think, was saying how we trained in a short period of time. I'm talking about the rifle companies now. And it said these companies were put together in 8 weeks. The age of the riflemen were basically 19, the NCOs 19 and a half, and the subalterns 20. And that sort of sums up. We were basically national servicemen, I would think, well, 85% of us, I would imagine. And I suppose, and the senior NCOs, like company commanders, were... most of them Second World War veterans, I think. But anyway, we were on Crowborough Station. I suppose we were all a little bit excited. None of us had ever been on a ship before, I don't suppose, or been abroad before. So we entrained and went down to Southampton. I think the band was there. Yes, it was. The band of the Royal Norfolk were there because we were going as a battalion. There were also drafts going out from various regiments who were in Korea and in Hong Kong, Middle East and Singapore and where have you in them days. Anyway, we entrained and got on the ship and we were shown our deck. If I remember right, there were three-tier bunks and the ship looked very good, actually, because I think the ship was a German passenger liner that was requisitioned after the Second World War, as, you know, part and parcel of us winning the war and them losing it. So it was a ship built as a bit of a liner. And these bunks were three tiers, I'm sure.
What were the mess decks? How many were there to the mess
decks? Oh, quite a few. They'd bung these bunks and there weren't a lot of room on the mess decks. No, they weren't. But we didn't eat in the mess decks like the Royal Navy do. We just slept there. It was just quarters, you know, to where you hang your... Most of your kit bags went down the hold, so you'd only got your personal small kit with you. You know, and we were all rather excited, I suppose. The band were playing. I don't think there were any civilians there. Maybe a few, I don't know, dock workers, I can't remember. We all come from basically East Anglia, which was down at Southampton, too far to come, even if the MOD would have let them, you know. We sailed off, and we were all on the rail, I suppose, looking at Isle of Wight, and, you know, wondering what this voyage were going to be, and it was certainly made of excitement, really, as young men would be. The first, I suppose we perhaps had a couple of days. Whenever we went through the Bay of Biscay, the day one or day two, whichever it would be, it were a bit rough. Well, I would thought blimmin' rough, really, because I were real seasick, and I weren't the only one. There were quite a few of us, and I could see other boats looking green, and we were just sort of sitting on the deck and doing what seasick people do, you know, being sick all over the blimmin' show.
How bad were you?
Well, I were quite... I didn't... None of us, as I know, had to have medical treatment, but I felt blimmin' rough, you know, really did. I don't think I could have... if they'd have said abandon ship, somebody had to show me where the lifeboat were. I didn't feel like capable of doing much. And that, I suppose, lasted for about 12 hours, maybe 24. But anyway, we were carrying on, and we gradually got over that. And as we approached Gibraltar to get into the Med, the sea must have levelled out and calmed down, and we went through the Mediterranean. First port of call was Port Said. Now, Port Said in them days was a bit of a dirty hole. It really were. I mean, none of us had ever seen any foreign ports like it, and we were a little bit disgusted in the dirty state of the town in general.
What do you mean by dirty?
Wow, there were mullock laying everywhere. They were like gullies, as I remember. They were gullies down the street. We'll call them. Well, there's one in Wells in Somerset like it that runs fresh water all the while. It's about foot and a half wide, about foot deep, and that's continually running lovely fresh water from the spring somewhere. But these were got all. Wastewater from the dwellings, I gather, you know, and we weren't very enthralled with that. The Arabs then knew British soldiers had got a food bob in the pocket, so they were all coming round. We used to call them bum boats. They come round the ship as you dock, and they show you purses and various trinkets. And the thing were that you'd lower a rope down. They may throw one up, I don't know, but you'd lower a rope down, and they'd put the thing in, the purse or whatever it were. You'd pull the rope up, and the deal had been done before the rope, I suppose, were threw up. But, you know, most people paid. Some of them, I think, thought it a bit funny to grab the article and not pay for it. But then the old Arabs were shouting about it and all things like that. And so that they festooned the boat, actually, when we docked. And, of course, when you get on shore, you're pestered by the same sort of thing. You know, you want to buy this, you want to buy that, and... I suppose that it was a legacy of where they were in the Second World War, when the soldiers had got the money and the Egyptians hadn't got much money, and the only way they get it was sell little trinkets and whatever, you know, for them. So anyway, we just had a few hours in Port Said. We got on the then embarked on the Orwell, and we went down through the Suez Canal, which was a bit of an experience, really, you know, very nice. The next port are called Raden.
Hang on, can I ask you about the training? Because it makes quite a lot of reference to there was quite a bit of training going on.
They were on the board, yeah, on training on board. Well, training on board was, for me being in the signal platoon, we were got together as a signal platoon, perhaps about 30 of us, I would say. And we then were still continuing intensive wireless training. I think we were still brushing up on our Morse, wireless procedures, a concise signal training were taking place with the signal platoon. Now, the rifle companies, they were doing, putting some, perhaps a buoy or something over the ship and firing off with a Bren gun. You know, they were having that sort of training, maybe lectures on field craft and things like that. But being in the signal platoon, we were kept well clear of that, really. So we were just in our own small group. At that time, we were told which company we were going to go. By that, I mean in a signal platoon, what they do when you're, we'll say, in a situation on active service, they break the signal platoon up. A certain percentage, an element of them, stop with battalion headquarters. Some go back to some of the rear echelons. Each rifle company in them days had two signalers, two permanent signalers with them. And that also applied to support company, they had two. And so you broke up like that. And at that time, I was put with a friend, which is fortunate for me, somebody I'd trained with at Colchester, and we were put with C Company. We didn't know anything about C Company. You know, we met Major Holden, the company commander, only just to be introduced to him. And he virtually said, you know, I suppose you get on with your training, lads, and I'll see you when we dock. Anyway, training carried on like that, signal platoon training. As I say, through the Mediterranean, Port Said, Aden, similar place to Port Said. Not quite so dirty as Port Said, we didn't think. Okay, a few hours stop there, back on board, then through to Colombo. Well, at Colombo, somebody had a bright idea that we'd do a route march. I'm not quite sure how far it were, but a fair old way. So we had to gear up with a small pack, and I don't think we got weapons. But anyway, this route march was, I suppose, in the hottest part of the day. And it was, you know, we done it. One or two of the regular soldiers who had got a bit big in the belly, they found it a little bit difficult towards the end, because they'd had a few years of peacetime soldiering, and the sergeants and senior NCOs had filled out a little bit in the waist, and they were puffing and blowing. I think one or two of them had to finish off dropping out. But we got round the route march, back on board, next port to call Singapore. Now, Singapore was lovely, really, because it was totally different. It was a lovely, clean city. It so happened we docked at Singapore when Singapore was declared a city. It was some civic celebration, big parades, with all the Chinese dragons, like you see, you know, yards long with people in them, and fireworks and things like that. So we got there just right. We thought that was very good. We enjoyed that. I think we went into the Raffles Hotel. That's what I've always been led to believe since, that it were the Raffles. And we had a cup of tea or coffee or what, lemonade or whatever we had in there. Because we had all heard about the Raffles Hotel from the, you know, from various aspects of British colonialism. So we had a nice spell at Singapore. From Singapore, of course, we were offloading people all the while because it was a British base, so they got married families on there come to join husbands, and you've got replacement soldiers and sailors and airmen who would come to replace people as in drafts. And the same applies to Hong Kong, the next port of call. We were offloaded people there. Now, Hong Kong was nice. We thought Hong Kong were very nice. One instance, well, not an instance, but some of it stands in mind in Hong Kong. Bear in mind, we were all young men, come from this country just after the war, so things were a little bit, rationing were tight in this country, and things were a bit black and bleak, and everybody were a bit fed up with a lot of things. I think, if I remember right, there were fuel crisis, coal crisis, and one thing another. Anyway, so when we get to Hong Kong, it was, you know, all gaily lit up, and a thriving, bustling Chinese town. All the sampans are in the harbour with the people living on them. We were there, I don't know, that's about a day perhaps. And I can always remember we got on the Kowloon ferry. That was like quite a big boat, the ferry, and there were seats all the way around the side on the deck. It was covered in one portion, and the open deck as well, seats all around it. And I remember we sat in this covered in section when we got on, and of course, some of these smart Chinese ladies come on, young girls come on and sat opposite us. Of course, they'd got that Chinese dress on that slits right up to the thigh. Oh, us old boys, we thought it was super, you know. We thought, crikey, these were the cat's whiskers when it comes to pretty women. By golly, you know, we sat there goggle-eyed at these Chinese ladies. They really did look attractive. Anyway, that soon passed, and then from there on, I suppose it was about 3 days to Pusan. We arrive at Pusan, pull into the dock, and there's an American Army coloured band. They're playing Glenn Miller tunes, When the Saints Go Marching In, all the old Glenn Miller tunes that we were familiar with. We thought, well, for a military band, that were cracking. So I suppose we get the kit out from the hold, and we all get kitted up. But a strange thing happened when we were embarking, if that's the right word, embarking. As we come up from the onto the decks, we all got all our kit with us, kit bags and everything with us. We were told then, as you get to the gangplank, throw your tin helmets in the cargo net. They've got a cargo net there spread out. So we thought, well, we're going to get a more modern tin hat. So and we come down the gangplank, and just before we get there, we throw the old tin out. So I got rid of my airborne tin out, and everybody else got rid of their little pork pie tin outs. We thought we were going to get some sort of a modern tin out. So we come on the boat, and anyway, to go forward a little bit, we never did get a tin out. We could never understand this. We'd done all our training from day one wearing a tin out, basically. Yet when we got to Korea, it was basically when we were there with basically trench warfare, when you could done with the tin hat. We never had a tin hat issued all the while we were there, which was strange. Anyway, we got down the gangplank, and they put us in, I think, in three tonners to take us to the station, or the train may have been at the dockside. I'm not quite sure on that. But we were then met with a sight of refugees, which we'd never seen before. I mean, we hadn't had much in this country, but we'd never see children who were begging for food. And they were crowding round in dozens all round us. And we were all issued with a box about still a bit bigger than a shoebox, and it was the old American C-7s. Now, that's a day ration pack. That was good. I mean, we had these numerous times in Korea, and I think they were an excellent 24-hour ration pack. if I can remember what was in them, we had this for the train journey up, you see, up to the front, up towards the front. They were something like perhaps two tins of main meal, like chicken and ham in a tin, corned beef hash in a tin, pork and beans in a tin. There'd be two of the main meal type tins. There'd be a tin of fruit. There'd be a packet of cigarettes. There was an accessory packet, we're called. It was a tin in its own right, and you open the top. In that tin, there'd be a packet of cigarettes. There'd be some water purifying tablets, box of matches, a packet of chewing gum, I think, toilet paper, a polythene bag, suited to the grow of your weapon. I maybe missed some, but that's what you'd be got in your little accessory pack. Then you'd be got a little tin of jam, food crackers. In other words, it was a good ration pack for 24 hours. So we got one of them issued. Of course, that's what the old kids were after, you see, because you know what British soldiers, all soldiers are. If you can see kids in need, you know you don't like to see them hungry. So we know they added a few different things to their little old kids. And also that time, when we were in the station or when we were on the train, I can't remember, but coming down from the north, these trains used to come in, and they're like we've seen on the pictures of the trains in India. They were festooned with people hanging on every vantage point. You know, we assume they're looking back now. They must have been refugees coming in from the north down to this Pusan area. But they really were hanging in. I mean, I don't think they could have tickets, because I don't know how they could have took the tickets from this number of people. But they were on the roof, hanging on every vantage point on that train as it come in. So that stuck in my memory. And from there on, let's see, we went up north then. It was a train with old wooden seats. And it was a fair old journey, because you kept getting pulled into the sidings for other people to go by, your more important train supplies, I suppose, or stuff coming down from up the north. Anyway, they were a train come by with wounded in, I think, and some of them said, ooh, that ain't a very good sight, you know, and Pat's got us a little bit nervous about that. But anyway, we carried on then, and what they'd done, as we got up, I think it weren't too far behind the line, but I don't think it was in shelled hearing distance. And they'd put a tented camp up, and it was called Britannia Camp, because it was the first time we were the first battalion to use it. And I think it was a staging post from then on all through the Korean War. And it maintained that name, Britannia Camp. We stopped there in, I think, our bell tents we were in. And I think we were there perhaps 2 days, something like that. I don't think I joined the company then. I'm pretty sure I hadn't joined the company. But from then on, we then went up in three tonners. But no, not through, they're American trucks, driven by black Americans. It seemed in them days, black Americans drove all the transport. And these big trucks, we all piled in the back of these, and we went forward. Now, we did go then within sound of the front line. You could hear the showers, etc. So we knew we were getting quite near the front line. Any place we went through, any reasonably big town, like Seoul, I think, was devastated. Nothing was standing worth above two or three bricks high, you know. Anyway, we then did join the company then, and Major Holden introduced himself again to us and to his officers. We may have joined them at Britannia Camp, but anyway, when we went up in the trucks, we were with C Company, and you know, we thought, well, this seems a nice enough man, Major Holden. And anyway, we got to this hillside. And Major Holden must have sent the platoons out to various positions. And he said, well, we're going to have company headquarters just here. And while it was on this hillside, a lovely grass hillside, there was a mound. I suppose it was about 2'6" to 3' high, about 6' long, maybe longer. And it all grassed over, this mound. And Major Holden said, we'll dig in here. So he said, I'll have the CP over this side, the command post over this side. And he said, you signallers dig in over that side. In other words, the mound separated us. So we just dug in there for the night. I don't think we worried about a roof over our head. We just scraped a hole out, perhaps about 2' deep. And we'd got sleeping bags then. We'd been issued with sleeping bags, a part of the you know, pre-Korean kit we got issued with. And we curled up there for the night. And it weren't until later in our time in Korea we realised these mounds are burial mounds. The Koreans bury their dead on hillsides, and they must scrape out a shallow grave, being a bit rocky. Then they've covered over in these mounds, you see. But So we didn't desecrate the grave at all, but we didn't realise at that time it was a Korean grave.
Now, whereabouts was it? Is this Koeng Sang area, as it's called?
Koeng Sang, I think, is 355. I'm pretty sure Koeng Sang. No, this was this weren't quite up to 355.
But it's that area.
Yes, it must have been that area. Yeah, it must have been that area. I don't think we stopped there, only that one night. Now, and from then on, I think we all entrucked again. And then we were told we were going to relieve the Royal Ulster Rifles. Right, so, okay, we get in these trucks. We go forward as far as the trucks can go up the supply routes, and we had to get out the trucks. The Ulsters were coming down. By golly, I reckon a lot of them were reservists. They looked like battle-hardened soldiers to us. They'd been there since the previous, April, I suppose, if not before. And they were all brown because they'd been out and by golly. And they were firing the weapons in the flipping air. And we wondered what was going on. Anyway, we took over from the Ulster Rifles. And Major Alden, evidently then, he must have done recce because he knew where his platoons were going. And the platoons were sent to their positions. And we arrive on this hillside. And it was on the side of 355, basically, which I'm sure is Karak San. And we were in the front line then. It had only been took over comparatively recently by, I think, the KOSB took it over. And it was at that time occupied by the King's Own Shropshire Light Infantry. And it really were in the front line in respect to shell fire. You could see them exploding on the sides of 355. You could see them exploding on 317, 217. The line at that time comprised of the King's Own Scottish Borders on 317, 217, to our right. The Norfolks then basically spread between the KOSB and the KSLI, who were on 355. So we were on towards 355 with company headquarters and the platoons. Anyway, we dug in there.
Now, what were the positions like you dug in?
Well, there were some earthworks there that had been dug that we took over. But whenever you take a position over, nothing suits your company commander or officers like somebody. They always want something slightly different. So we then constructed a signal dugout, and Major Alden, he had his CP next to us, quite close proximity to us. At that time, we took 62 set with us. Now, the 62 set I mentioned early on is quite a heavy set. You know, a backpack set is a heavy old set to lug around. Also, you've got a battery, somewhat like a small car battery you've got to take with it, and a little petrol charging engine. Anyway, we didn't know what the situation was going to be, so we not only got two 31 sets and a spare 88 set, we've got a 62 set, a little charging engine, and a battery to go with it. So we got that established in this dugout. We've got the charging engine. On the reverse side of the hill, we've got these dugouts. We've got the charging engine up and running, and we made certain it started. Anyway, then it come through that we should be told if 62 sets were going to be used and when. So that were fine. We then, I think, made certain that the telephone lines that were out to the platoons that had already been laid were still there. Any that weren't, we laid telephone wires from the signal dugout to the outlying platoons. That meant we could communicate with a field telephone, you see, which is more secure, really, than a radio wave. Anyway, we got that done. Now, you see, this would, let's see, we're going in timescale. This must have been about the last little while of October, I should think. Maybe the last 2 weeks of October when we got on here, on this hill. And 355 had only been took a matter of about perhaps a month. 317, I think the same, only been took a month. So it were all quite new and a bit, the battlefield really was a bit fluid in them days. Anyway, we dug in there and we carried on. And I'm trying to think, get it in chronological order. Well, we hadn't been there many days. And they said, and I've never quite understood what this patrol were for. And I've asked Tom Henson this, and he couldn't remember the patrol because he weren't on it. Anyway, we had a patrol, and I think it was platoon strength. It went quite a bit forward, and it was led by Lieutenant Fitzgerald, who was, I believe then, was one of the C Company officers. And he led us there, and it was an overnight patrol. We went out in the afternoon, we went quite way forward, there were two signals sent with two 31 sets. I could never really understand that. Anyway, we did, and we were in contact with battalion headquarters. We went onto a hill which had recently changed hands from... it had been evacuated, how can we say, pretty hastily by a British regiment, because there were a lot of equipment laying around. There was even a 19 set in one of the dugouts that had been left in a hurry. So when this was left, and I don't know when or what, who got out of it quick, but that had happened on that hillside. And there were also Chinese trenches. So we had to get ourselves in these trenches. We didn't dig new ones. We just used the trenches that were there for this night. The Chinese trenches were fascinating. Really. They were very deep, maybe 8 foot deep, very narrow, straight down. And at the bottom of these trenches, you'd find a hole, perhaps about 2 foot diameter, which would go into the hillside and then gradually go up. And in there, there'd be a bowl, I don't know, perhaps 12 foot diameter. And it was the walls were smooth, as if they'd... as if the mud had been smoothed round with wet tools, like you would a plaster, you know, it looked like that. There are no Chinese in there. I think there are a bit of Chinese tackle laying around, but that was interesting having a look in there. Anyway, from that night, we spent on that hillside, and a friend of mine, he was with us as well, who was in one of the platoons. He thinks the object of it were to bring on fire across the valley at some Chinese positions, but I really don't know whether that's right or not. I can never understand what the idea of the patrol were, but anyway, it could have been that we were giving cover in fire or something like that. But the next morning we packed up, we come back, and we could see as we come back down the paddy fields towards 355, we could see the Chinese mortar or shell pop on the side of 355. So we knew they were still actively popping away at the positions, right? Anyway, this was, I should think, round about the end of October, beginning of November.
You don't know the name of the feature? You
No, I don't. No, we called it Fitz's Pimple. It was called Fitz's Pimple, I'm pretty sure, as a code name. You see, you know, as regard a wireless code name, I'm pretty sure it was called Fitz's Pimple, after Lieutenant Fitzgerald. Anyway, we got back to our positions, and this, I think, was, as I say, last week in October, perhaps, or very nearly into November. Now,
what were your defensive positions like? Can you describe your...
Yes, our defensive positions on this hill were trenches dug in, like a weapon... I'm just visualising the trench, like the signaller's trench now. Well, at the front there was a weapon pit, which was... we've got a Bren gun on the front, which that must have been a company headquarters Bren gun, because we didn't carry one of the signallers. A Bren gun on the front, and you've got a little, you've got a couple of three or four sandbags across, and then a little gap for the old Bren gun. You'd stand there, and you'll be about the right firing height. Just behind that, we've got the signallers dugout. Well, we dug this, or perfected this hole in the ground. It would perhaps be about 4 foot deep, and we'd got some timbers that were laying around, like bits of tree that had been blown about by shells, etc. We put them over the top, and also the old American barbed wire pickets were like what we'd call very near angle iron. They were kind of a square angle iron type thing, and they were different sizes, but the big pickets you could put across your dugout top, and on top of them you could put a grain sheet perhaps on top of them, or layer of sandbags then your grain sheet. So we were quite snug in there. And that was basically, we had a field telephone there as well. And the old 62 said, I remember we hung it up at the back off one of these pickets. We got some telephone wire and we tied it around top of the two of the pickets in the roof, so they suspended. And we made a kind of a sling, and the old 62 set sat there. But we were never using it on the battalion net. So bear in mind, we'd already charged the battery. We got shortwave on there, so we could play around and get FEN, American Far East Network, you see. So we could when we were curled up in the old sleeping bags at night, if we weren't on stag, we could play around with that wireless and get a bit of Far East Network on there. So that did do a bit of good, the old 62 set.
That was for music then?
Well, for music, yeah, it was, yeah. Just not loud, but just for ourselves, you see. And